Our world is lost in unnecessary fear and hurt. Our systems seem scientifically engineered to make you small, powerless, and always waiting for the next great leader who will fix the problems around us. Worse, we're witnessing neighbor versus neighbor while warfare breaks out around our family tables. But you have access to a spirit, a strength that enlarges and empowers you. Even better, you don't need to wait for the next big movement. You can heal the world. It's time for governance by grace. Welcome to Gracearchy with Jim Babka. So as a capitalist, why do I need somebody to coerce me to be, force me to be a socialist against my will when I know that the rising tide of capitalism is going to raise your boat too?
You don't. And by the way, it's not socialism. This is where people get a little confused. It's not socialism to share. Sharing is an act that someone can enter into voluntarily, and they do it all the time. So the most obvious example are parents. You ever notice that parents work exactly in the opposite way that government works? Did you tax your kids growing up?
Right.
Did you expect them to produce something and give back to you? Right. And know that you became a servant to them. And then was that without benefit to you? Did you get reward from that? Was there value in that process for you? When you share with others, is there reward and a process that comes back to you? So I kind of out of hand reject altruism, because I think altruism and unicorns are largely the same thing. That is, they're a nice idea that don't actually exist. Okay? We can draw them, we can talk about them, we can theorize about them, in the abstract they exist, but in reality they don't. And what I mean by that is that people engage in acts of kindness all the time, but they do it because it brings value to them. That value could be something simple like feeling good, or it could be more complex. They have a long-term picture about a person that they love and care about. And it could be anything in between. But those are values that they accrue to themselves. My big issue in life is that too often people say, well, we're not going to have enough compassion if we don't force people. But that's a contradiction in terms.
Yes.
You can't actually have compassion if it was done by coercion.
Right. So this is the act of helping you is a selfish act, because I know that my thing will be better, whatever it is, when your thing is better.
I hate to go all Ayn Rand on you, but that's literally what she argued. She literally said there was a virtue in selfishness, and this was the specific thing that she meant. So it's not really good marketing, but it is philosophically sound.
So how do we sell that? What's the marketing behind that? Is that Javier Milei?
Javier Milei. So first off, as people are able to go out and create businesses for themselves and seek economic opportunity, they will bring new things, goods and services to people.
Sure. There's climate change, right?
Yeah. There's an idea in economics that is very important and powerful. And this is essentially one of the things that there's a fight between right and left. So the left-wing economics tends to be demand side. So they argue that if we send money to people, they'll buy more stuff and then everybody will be wealthier. But that is exactly the formula that we've used here in the United States to get the inflation that we've gotten. It drove up our debts and deficits.
Yep.
The other view is more of a supply side approach. And what I mean by that is nothing exists until it is produced. So Say's law says something similar to that. It's not precise. I'm using kind of back of the napkin economics here, but it seems so obvious that people miss it. You can't buy a thing that doesn't exist. So the shirt that you're wearing right now, Bill, you're always wearing a black shirt on our program. The shirt that you're wearing, somebody had to make it in order for you to wear it. You understand? Okay.
Sure.
Now that seems Jim. Okay. But in order to get that made, someone had to produce it. It wasn't sold. You hadn't bought that shirt until it was made.
Yeah.
So what capitalism does is it comes in and it provides that. That's the structure. And that's the structure. That's the method. But it's real people who separated from their own money and said, I'm going to go into the business of selling a shirt, long before they knew your name or saw your face coming into their store to buy it. So production precedes, this is more close to Say's law, production precedes consumption. You have to have something made first.
It's almost common sense.
Okay. Now, to answer your question, as people become producers, they are doing so with the intention. They're not doing it out of the good. They didn't wake up and say, you know what, I think Bill needs a shirt, and then start a business. They did it because they wanted to take care of their own family. They wanted to advance their own personal interests. They were, quote unquote, selfish. So this selfishness then is it drives their behavior. This goes all the way back to Adam Smith, right? He says that the butcher and the candle maker, and I don't know who else, he said that these people didn't do what they do for you. They did it for themselves. But because they do it, it's almost as if an invisible hand shows up and starts coordinating all these activities. Everybody suddenly gets wealthier because of it. Now, the visible hand is just a metaphor. It's not a controller. It's not somebody actually doing it. These activities are not coordinated. The person who sold you the shirt did not coordinate with you. But by doing what they did, they sold the shirt and they made a profit. And the profit allows them first to take and meet their own needs. And then it allows them to do more. So think about this. To keep this really super simple, the wealthy view their money or their budget way different than the rest of us do. The overwhelming majority of our budget, we all pay taxes. Everyone's on the same footing at the beginning of that. But the overwhelming majority of their budget is either going to go to charity or it's going to go into investment. Whereas you and I spend the overwhelming majority on consumption. So if you cut my pay dramatically, it affects my standard of living. You cut their pay dramatically, it only reduces the amount they give to charity or reinvest. Their standard of living remains the same.
Yep.
We want them to be as successful as they are for the very fact that they will be of public good. They'll be of good to you and me because they can't consume everything. They can't eat every dollar they're earning. They have to redirect it into something else. And that is where Say's law comes in. They start producing the goods and services. They make the shirts and they do the other stuff. And consequently, the more shirts that get made, the less expensive your shirt is. That's a good, right? The fact that shirts are readily available, that's a good. The fact that because in the production of the shirt and the selling of the shirt and the marketing and advertising of the shirt and the building of the plant and all the rest of the stuff, when jobs were created, those are all goods, obviously, to the families for where those jobs exist. So they end up doing good that way.
So how do we address the naysayer who says, well, the wealthy have too much income. We've got to get that redistributed somehow. Look at income inequality, yada, yada. How do we explain that this redistribution or this accumulation is being redistributed in a way that is meaningful that the middle class can feel?
So the reference I always go back to is Jeff Bezos. I always bring up Jeff Bezos because everybody knows his name. He's mega wealthy. And if you're watching or listening to the show right now, the odds are incredibly high that the way that you got it was through an AWS server. The A in AWS stands for Amazon, the company that he founded and built to become as wealthy as he is, which is, by the way, a level of wealth you can't even begin to imagine. So now he can't eat all of what he earns. He can't sleep on all of that he earns. He can't ride around in all of that he earns, right? He doesn't consume it all. What he does is he produces. And so what AWS is servers. They're like the largest server farm you could possibly imagine. Okay. And that's how we get the information. Now, he's not living in his server farm. He's not eating his server farm. You get what I'm saying? Like, he's not, yeah. He can't consume that. In fact, the people that are consuming his server farm are us. So, you know, when you hear people say, eat the rich, we literally do. This is how we do it. Like, we get their stuff. They build stuff that we get to enjoy.
We want to see his net worth diminish in order to know that that's actually happening, right?
No, see, that's completely wrong. My father put it rather colloquially when I was a young man. He said, I don't know why people hate the rich so much. I've never gotten a job from anyone else, right? These are the men that give the jobs.
Yep.
It wasn't maybe exactly that way, but you get the point. And then at the end of the day, we all have a desire to be more wealthy than we are now. Well, the definition of too wealthy, I keep seeing this again and again. The definition of too wealthy is somebody who makes an amount of money that I can never imagine myself making. You talk to people. You scratch away at the surface in these conversations. You should be able to get at a number. And by the way, they also clam up because they start to realize that what you're pointing out. I've had that experience as well. It just happened to me in November in a conversation I had. His pucker went right shut. He realized where I was going. Okay. Yep. He was talking about people being too wealthy. It turned out it had to do with how much he thought he would ever make. And my favorite example, this is Bernie Sanders, who is a socialist who believes it's a crime to be a billionaire. Now, I just said that out loud. He actually believes it's a crime to be a billionaire. These people should pay a lot more money because they must have gotten it somehow or other illegitimately. No one should have that much money.
Billions and billions, you'll say,
right?
Yeah. Yep.
Pick that number because he's worth more than $10 million. That's why he picked that number. He's very wealthy. He has three houses. Okay. So,
write a best-selling book and then you can make as much money as I did.
You know, it's absurd. So I'm trying to say to you that people having this amount of wealth is more beneficial to you than it is to them. If we give it to the government, here's the last part of this. If we give it to the state, okay, each person who is wealthy because they have an industry or a business is so because they have served people. The customer is always right, and this is a regulator on their behaviors. So if they do something to damage their business, right, through public reputation, or if they provide inferior service and customer support, or if they charge too much money, right, or if the product is dangerous and defective, if any of these things accrue to them, they could lose this position. So what these people really are at the end of the day, whether they realize it or not, the most successful amongst us, what they really are in the capital creation business is they're resource allocation specialists.
I'm with you on this.
They're hyper competent at it. And the thing is, just like professional sports, the very best of the best resource allocators will come into the market and compete against them. So they could lose their position in a heartbeat. They could lose their status and position, and businesses close all the time that were successful 5 and 10 and 15 years ago. The Kmart put out this great commercial a handful of years ago. I just shipped my pants, right? They were already a company in decline at that point, and they're basically gone. But they used to dot the landscape all over the place.
Oh, yeah.
Right? So companies come and go because they... a competitor arrived that was better at the resource allocation game. All right. Now, if they can optimize their resource allocation ability, you as a consumer benefit and investors in that company benefit. Both parties benefit. The government always spends more. There's a whole list of reasons for this, but let's say that you have to create a job, and in the private sector, it costs $130,000 to create a given position. The government will create that same position at a cost of $180,000 or $190,000, a comparable position. They will have additional costs and expenses in doing it. In other words, they are an inefficient resource allocator. So less wealth is created. And it's really easy to see why. If you had to employ 10 people, would you want to pay $180,000 or $130,000? Right?
Right. Yeah.
And if you can pay 130, that means you, one of two things can happen. Either you can, or both, you can lower the price of your good or service, or you can squeeze out more profit for your shareholders.
Yeah.
Okay. So this is what they're doing all day long, is trying to figure out how to maximize that thing. So when we send resources, like Mr. Wonderful says on Shark Tank, off to a bad place, you're sending dollars to die. You're sending money to die, right? You're misspending it. And when we send it to the government, we are commonly misspending the money. When the voluntary sector could handle this issue, they are almost always going to do it more efficiently, and more human beings will benefit from the process. It ultimately turns into a taking on this basis.
Yes. No, I'm with you on that, because it's the misunderstanding of selfishness.
Okay, so let's go back to the jobs for a second. I just created jobs at 130 and 180. Which long term, which is going to be a process that will create more jobs? The 130,000 position or the 180,000 position?
No, the 130, obviously.
Okay, and can people get by if they're making, because there's healthcare and insurance and tax, whatever. So we're probably actually talking a gross income of like $95,000, $100,000 a year based on that figure.
We should point out that although the cost of those jobs is different, the individual doing the job is most likely earning the same.
Yes. So you're exactly right. So the $100,000 that we're talking about here now that they're making, can people get by on that in the United States in 2024?
Oh, geez. It's getting tight, even at 100K.
Yeah, I recognize, like, you live in California, and it probably, like, to in Ohio, $100,000 is still big money. So yeah. My example probably isn't quite good enough. But you get what I'm trying to say, right? That's not a McDonald's, sear the burger position. Right?
No, it's not.
Flip it. It's not that position.
There's very little open territory between 50K and about 120K. Okay. Not many jobs that fall in that middle space anymore in California.
Well, in California, I'm sure that's a little bit harder. So the economic principle stands. You just have to adjust the numbers to your territory.
Yeah. Because, you know, like the county of San Diego will create a position that somebody else could be doing in the voluntary sector. Well done. Someone else could be doing that would cost all of us less, and in the voluntary sector would raise more boats than it would in the government sector.
Yes, it would.
Okay, I'm with you on that. I appreciate the time, like, answering this question. It's been bugging me for a while.
Well, this is really good, because I don't know. Like, you could almost play this for your kids. I don't know how many people actually understand how all these pieces connect together.
Yep. Well, they've been going to the government schools where this stuff isn't taught, because it's...
So let me bring this down one more level before we close. Let me bring this down to you and me, okay? Everybody wants to be in a position where they have enough money to pay their bills and then a little extra to save. That is a desirable position to be in. That's the minimum desirable position. Now, you might like to have lots of money to save, but you want to at least be at that position where you have a little that you can put aside for a rainy day. Okay. Yeah. You're able to pay your bills, you get by, plus you have some extra. That's what everybody wants to get to. And that extra is what makes charity possible. That extra is what makes the ability to share possible. Your first responsibility is to pay your own obligations. And 1B, that's 1A, 1B is the people that you've brought into this world. You have certain people that you made a commitment to in your household and so forth, or maybe they're not, you know, you're separated or whatever. You have kids, you have offspring, you have responsibilities to them. But after you've met those obligations, your ability to do other things has to do with how you spend your budget, and even more so, whether or not you have any left over. And it's easier to be generous when you have something to share.
Yes.
When it's not directly coming off of your own plate. Doesn't mean you can't. There are people who make trade-offs and say, I'm going to eat vegetables tonight and skip the meat so I can share with a friend. Got it, right? I'm going to eat, you know, ramen. You can do that, okay? But long-term, that's not really a good strategy. The better strategy is to be in a position where you've arrived at that point. And what happens for the wealthy in their charitable giving? If you met somebody, I have the privilege of having somebody close in my life who is a billionaire. If you have met somebody who makes that kind of money and has that kind of wealth, you would be stunned by how much money they give away. It's staggering. And they love it. They get joy out of it. So this idea that somehow they're greedy and selfish and so forth, it's just not the way it works. Right? They see things that need to be fixed in the world, and they invest in it all the time. And it is true, like my dad said, it's the rich man that gives you your job.